The party. After school, we go to Allie's. When we were younger, freshman year and even half of sophomore year, we'd sometimes stay in and put on clay masks and order as much Chinese food as we could eat, taking 20s from the cookie jar on the third shelf next to Allie's refrigerator, where her dad keeps an emergency $1,000 at all times. We called them our egg roll emergency nights. Then we'd stretch out on her enormous couch and watch movies until we fell asleep. The TV in Allie's living room is as big as the screen in a movie theater, our legs tangled together under an enormous fleece blanket. Since junior year, though, I don't think we've stayed in even once, except when Matt Wilde broke up with Allie and she cried so hard that the next morning her face was puffy like a mole's. Today, we raid Allie's closet so we don't have to wear the same outfit to Kent's party. Elodie, Allie, and Lindsay are paying special attention to how I look. Elodie puts bright red polish on my nails, her hands shaking a little so some of it gets on my cuticles and makes it look like I'm bleeding. But I'm too nervous to care. Rob and I are going to meet up at Kent's, and he's already sent me a text that says, "I even made my bed for you." I let Allie pick out my outfit. A metallic gold tank top, too big in the chest, and a pair of Allie's crazy 4-inch heels. She calls them her stripper shoes. Lindsay does my makeup, humming and breathing vodka onto me. We've all taken 2 shots, chasing them with cranberry juice. Afterward, I lock myself in the bathroom, warmth tingling from my fingertips up to my head, and try to memorize exactly how I look there, in that second. But after a while, all of my features seem like they're just hanging there, like something I'm seeing on a stranger. When I was little, I used to do this a lot. Lock myself in the bathroom and take showers so hot the mirrors would cloud completely over, then stand there, watching as my face took shape, slowly behind the steam. Rough outlines at first, then details appearing gradually. Each time I'd think that when my face came back, I would see somebody beautiful. Like during my shower, I would have transformed into someone brighter and better. But I always looked the same. Standing in Allie's bathroom, I smile and think, tomorrow I'll finally be different. Lindsay's kind of music obsessed, so she makes us a playlist for the ride to Kent's house, even though he lives only a few miles away. We listen to Dr. Dre and Tupac, and then we blast Baby Got Back and all sing along. It's the weirdest thing, though. As we're driving there, along all those familiar streets, streets I've known my whole life, streets so familiar I might as well have imagined them myself, I get this feeling like I'm floating above everything, hovering above all of the houses and the roads and the yards and the trees, going up, 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 above Rockies and the Rite Aid and the gas station and Thomas Jefferson and the football field and the metal bleachers where we sit and scream our heads off every homecoming. Like everything is tiny and insignificant. Like I'm already only remembering it. Elodie's howling at the top of her lungs. She has the lowest tolerance out of all of us. Allie's got the rest of the vodka tucked into her bag, but nothing to chase it with. Lindsay's driving because she can drink all night and hardly feel it. The rain starts when we're almost there, but it's so light it's almost like it's just hanging in the air, like a big curtain of white vapor. I don't remember the last time I was at Kent's house. His 9th birthday party, maybe? And I've forgotten how far it's set back in the woods. The driveway seems to snake on forever. All we see is the dull light from the headlights bouncing off a twisting, gravelly path and revealing dead tree branches crowding closely overhead and tiny pellets of rain like diamonds. "This is how horror movies start," Allie says, adjusting her tank top. We've all borrowed new tops from her, but she's insisted on keeping on the fur-trimmed one, even though she was the one who was initially against it. "Are you sure he's number 42? "It's just a little farther," I say, even though I have no idea, and I'm starting to wonder whether we turned too early. I have butterflies in my stomach, but I'm not sure whether they're good or bad. The woods press closer and closer until they're nearly brushing up against the car doors. Lindsay starts complaining about the paint job. Just when it seems like we'll be sucked up into the darkness, all of a sudden, the woods stop completely, and there's the biggest, most beautiful lawn you can imagine, with a white house at its center that looks like it's made out of frosting. It's got balconies and a long porch that runs along two sides. The shutters are white, too, and carved with designs it's too dark to make out. I don't remember any of it. Maybe it's the alcohol, but I think it's the most beautiful house I've ever seen. We're all silent for a minute, looking. Half the house is dark, but warm light is shining from the top floor, and where it makes it to the lawn, it turns the grass silver. Lindsay says, "It's almost as big as your house, Al." I'm sorry she spoke. It feels like a spell has been broken. "Almost," Allie says. She takes the vodka out of her bag and swigs it, coughs, burps, and wipes her mouth. "Give me a shot of that," Elodie says, reaching for the bottle. The bottle's in my hand before I realize it. I take a sip. It burns my throat and tastes awful, like paint or gasoline. But as soon as it's down, I get a rush. We climb out of the car, and the light from the house surges and expands, winking at me. Walking into parties always gives me a crampy feeling at the bottom of my stomach. It's a good feeling, though, the feeling of knowing anything can happen. Most of the time, nothing does, of course. Most of the time, one night blends into the next, and weeks blend into weeks, and months into other months, and sooner or later, we all die. But at the beginning of the night, anything's possible. The front door is locked, and we have to go around the side, where a door opens onto a really narrow hallway all paneled in wood and a tiny flight of steep wooden stairs. It smells like something I remember from childhood, but I can't quite place it. I hear the tinkle of breaking glass, and someone yells, "Fire in the hole!" Then Dugius roars from the speakers, "All MCs in the house tonight, if your lyrics sound tight, then rock the mic!" The stairs are so narrow we have to squeeze up in single file because people are coming down in the opposite direction, empty beer cups in hand. Most of them have to turn so their backs are against the wall. We say hi to a few people and ignore the rest. As usual, I can feel all of them looking at us. That's another nice thing about being popular. You don't have to pay any attention to the people paying attention to you. At the top of the stairs, a dim hallway is hung all over with multicolored Christmas lights. There are a series of rooms, each leading off the next, and all seem to be filled with draped fabrics and big pillows and couches, and all are packed with people. Everything is soft. The colors, the surfaces, the way people look, except the music, which pumps through the walls, making the floor vibrate. People are smoking inside, too, so everything's happening behind a thick blue veil. I've only smoked pot once, but this is what I imagine it's like to be stoned. Lindsay leans back and says something to me, but it gets lost in the murmur of voices. Then she's moving away from me, weaving through the crowd. I turn around, but Elodie and Allie are gone, too, and before I know it, my heart is pounding and I get this itchy feeling in my palms. Recently, I've been having this nightmare where I'm standing in the middle of an enormous crowd being pushed from left to right. The faces look familiar, but there's something horribly wrong with all of them. Someone will walk by who looks like Lindsay, and then her mouth is weird and droopy like it's melting off. And none of them recognize me. Obviously, standing in Kent's house isn't the same thing, since I pretty much know everybody except for some of the juniors and a couple of girls who I think might be sophomores. But still, it's enough to make me freak out a little. I'm about to head over to Emma Hauser. She's super cheesy, and normally I wouldn't be caught dead talking to her, but I'm getting desperate when I feel thick arms around me and smell lemon balm. Rob. He puts a wet mouth against my ear.
"Sexy Sammy, where have you been all my life?"
I turn around. His face is bright red. "You're drunk," I say, and it comes out more accusatory than I meant it to.
"Sober enough," he says,
trying and failing to raise one eyebrow.
"And you're late."
His grin is lazy. Only one half of it curves upward.
We did a keg stand.
It's 10 o'clock, I point out. We're not late. I called you anyway. He pats his fleece and his pockets.
Must have put my phone down somewhere.
I roll my eyes. You're a delinquent.
I like it when you use those big words.
The other half of his smile is creeping upward slowly, and I know he's gonna kiss me. I turn partly away, searching the room for my friends, but they're still MIA. In the corner, I spot Kent, wearing a tie and a collared shirt about three sizes too big for him, which is half tucked into a pair of ratty khakis. At least he's not wearing his bowler hat. He's talking to Phoebe Reifer, and they're laughing about something. It annoys me that he hasn't noticed me yet. I'm kind of hoping he'll look up and come barreling over to me like he usually does, but he just bends closer toward Phoebe like he's trying to hear her better. Rob pulls me into him.
Only stay for an hour, okay? Then we'll leave.
His breath smells like beer, and a little like cigarettes when he kisses me. I close my eyes and think about how in sixth grade I saw him kissing Gabby Haynes and was so jealous I couldn't eat for 2 days. I wonder if I look like I'm enjoying it. Gabby did, in sixth grade. It relaxes me to think about things like that. How funny life is. I haven't even taken off my jacket, but Rob unzips it and moves his hands along my waist and then under my tank top. His palms are sweaty and big. I pull away long enough to say, "Not right here, in the middle of everyone."
"Nobody's watching,"
he says and clamps down on me again. This is a lie. He knows everyone watches us. He can see it. He doesn't even close his eyes. His hands inch over my stomach and his fingers are pulling at the underwire of my bra. He's not very good with bras. He's not that good with breasts in general, actually. I mean, it's not like I really know what it's supposed to feel like, but every time he touches my boobs, he kind of just massages them hard in a circle. My gyno does the same thing when I go in for an exam, so one of them has to be doing it wrong. And to be honest, I don't think it's my gyno. If you want to know my biggest secret, here it is. I know you're supposed to wait to have sex with someone you love and all that, and I do love Rob. I mean, I've kind of been in love with him forever, so how could I not? But that's not why I decided to have sex with him tonight. I decided to have sex with him because I want to get it over with, and because sex has always scared me, and I don't want to be scared of it anymore.
I can't wait to wake up next to you,
Rob says, his mouth against my ear. It's a sweet thing to say, but I can't concentrate while his hands are on me. And it occurs to me all of a sudden that I'd never thought about the waking up part. I have no idea what you're supposed to talk about the day after you've had sex. And I imagine us lying side by side, not touching, silent, while the sun rises. Rob doesn't have any blinds in his room. He ripped them down once when he was drunk. And during the day, it's like a spotlight has been turned on his bed. A spotlight or an eye.
Get a room!
I pull away from Rob as Allie appears next to me, making a face.
You two are perverts, she says.
This is a room.
Rob lifts both arms and gestures around him. He sloshes a little bit of beer onto my shirt, and I make a noise, annoyed.
Sorry, babe,
he shrugs. Now there's only a half inch of beer in his cup, and he stares at it, frowning.
Gonna go for a topper. You guys want?
We brought our own. Allie pats the vodka in her purse.
Smart thinking.
Rob brings a finger up to tap the side of his head, but nearly takes an eye out instead. Ugh, he's drunker than I thought. Allie covers her mouth and giggles. My boyfriend's an idiot, I say as soon as he lurches away.
A cute idiot,
Allie corrects me. That's like saying a cute mutant. Doesn't exist.
Sure it does.
Allie's looking around the room, pouting her lips to make them look more kissable. Where did you go, anyway? I'm feeling more annoyed than I should by everything, by the fact that my friends ditched me after 30 whole seconds, by the fact that Rob's so drunk, by the fact that Kent's still talking to Phoebe Reifer even though he's supposed to be obsessively in love with me. Not that I want him to be in love with me, obviously. It's just a constant that's always been comforting, in a weird way. I wrestle the bottle out of Allie's bag and take another sip. We made a round. There's like 17 different rooms up here. You should check it out. Allie looks at me, notices the face I'm pulling, and holds up her hands. What? It's not like we abandoned you in the middle of nowhere. She's right. I don't know why I'm feeling so pissy. Where did Lindsay and Elodie go? Elodie's suctioned to Muffin's lap, and Lindsay and Patrick are fighting. Already? Yeah, well, they kissed for the first 3 minutes. They waited until minute 4 to start going at it. This cracks me up, and Allie and I laugh over it. I start to feel better, more comfortable. The vodka fills my head with warmth. More people are arriving all the time, and the room seems to be revolving just a little bit. It's a nice feeling, though, like being on a really slow carousel. Allie and I decide to go on a mission to save Lindsay before her fight with Patrick turns into an all-out brawl. It seems like the whole school has shown up, but really there are only 60 or 70 kids. This is the most that ever shows up at a party. There's the top and middle of the senior class, popularity-wise. Kent's just holding on to the lower rung of the ladder, but he's hosting, so it's okay. Some of the cooler juniors and a couple of really cool sophomores. I know I'm supposed to hate them, like we were hated when we were sophomores at all the senior parties, but I can't bring myself to care. Allie gives a group of them one of her ice stares as we go by, though, and says, "Skanks!" loudly. One of them, Rachel Cornish, supposedly hooked up with Matt Wilde not long ago. Obviously, no freshmen are allowed in. The social bottom doesn't show either. It isn't because people would make fun of them, although they probably would. It's more than that. They don't hear about these parties until after they've happened. They don't know the things we know. They don't know about the secret side entrance to Andrew Roberts' guest house, or the fact that Carly Jablonski stashed a cooler in her garage where you can keep your beers cold, or the fact that Rockies doesn't check IDs very closely, or the fact that Mix stays open around the clock and makes the best egg and cheeses in the world, absolutely dripping with oil and ketchup, perfect for when you're drunk. It's like high school holds two different worlds, revolving around each other and never touching. The haves and the have-nots. I guess that's a good thing. High school is supposed to prepare you for the real world, after all. There are so many tiny hallways and rooms, it feels like a maze. All of them are filled with people and smoke. Only one door is closed. It has a big keep out sign plastered on it over a bunch of weird bumper stickers that say things like, "Visualize world peace," and "Kiss me, I'm Irish." By the time we get to Lindsay, she and Patrick have made up. Big surprise. She's sitting on his lap and he's smoking a joint. Elodie and Steve Doe are in a corner. He's leaning against the wall and she's half dancing and half grinding against him. She has an unlit cigarette dangling from her lips, butt end out, and her hair is a mess. Steve is steadying her, using one arm to keep her on her feet, but he's having a conversation with Liz Hummer, her real name and, coincidentally, her car, like Elodie isn't even there, much less rubbing on him. "Poor Elodie," I say. I don't know why I suddenly feel bad for her. She's too nice. "She's a whore," Allie says, but not meanly. "Do you think we'll remember any of this?" I'm not sure where the words come from. My whole head feels light and fuzzy, ready to float away. Do you think we'll remember any of it 2 years from now?
I won't even remember it tomorrow.
Allie laughs, tapping the bottle in my hand. There's only a quarter of it left. I can't think when we drank it all. Lindsay squeals when she sees us and stumbles off Patrick's lap, throwing an arm around each of us like it's been years since we were together. She snatches the vodka from me and takes a sip while her arm is still wrapped around my shoulders, her elbow tightening momentarily against my neck.
"Where did you go?"
she yells. Her voice is loud even over the music and the sound of everybody talking and laughing.
"I was looking everywhere for you."
"Bullshit," I say, and Allie says, In Patrick's mouth, maybe.
We're laughing over the fact that Lindsay's a bullshitter and Elodie's a drunk and Allie's OCD and I'm antisocial. And someone cracks a window to let out the smoke and a fine mist of rain comes in, smelling like grass and fresh things, even though it's the dead middle of winter. Without anyone noticing, I reach my hand back and rest it on the sill, enjoying the freezing air and the sensation of 100 pinpricks of rain. I close my eyes and promise myself I'll never forget this moment. The sound of my friends' laughter and the heat from so many bodies and the smell of rain. When I open my eyes, I get the shock of my life. Juliet Sykes is standing in the doorway, staring at me. She's staring at us, actually. Lindsay, Allie, and Elodie, who has just left Steve and come over to stand with us and me. Juliet's hair is pulled back in a ponytail, and I think it's the first time I've ever really seen her face. It's shocking that she's there, but it's even more shocking that she's pretty. She has blue eyes set wide apart and high cheekbones like a model's. Her skin is perfectly clear and white. I can't stop staring at her. People are elbowing and pushing her because she's blocking the doorway, but she just stands there, staring. Allie catches on first, and her mouth drops open. What the? Elodie and Lindsay turn to see what we're both staring at. Lindsay goes pale at first. She actually looks afraid, which is beyond strange. But I don't have time to wonder about it because just as quickly, her face goes purple, and she looks ready to rip someone's head off. That's a more natural look for her. Elodie begins giggling hysterically until she doubles over and has to cover her mouth with both hands. I can't believe it, she says. I can't believe it. She tries to start singing Psycho Killer Qu'est-ce que c'est, but we're all still in shock and don't join in. You know how in movies someone says or does something inappropriate and the record scratches and there's dead silence all of a sudden? Well, that isn't exactly what happens, but it's close. The music doesn't stop, but as everyone in the room starts to pick up on the fact that Juliet Sykes, bedwetter, freak, and all-around psycho, is standing in the middle of a party giving four of the most popular girls at Thomas Jefferson the stink eye, conversation drops off, and a low sound of whispering fills the room, getting louder and more insistent until it's a constant hum, until it sounds like wind or the ocean. Juliet Sykes finally steps away from the door and into the room. She walks slowly and confidently toward us. I've never seen her look so calm, stopping 3 feet in front of Lindsay. You're a bitch, she says. Her voice is steady and too loud, like she's deliberately addressing everyone in the room. I'd always imagined her voice would be high-pitched or breathy, but it's as full and deep as a boy's. It takes Lindsay a half second to find her voice. Excuse me, she croaks out. Juliet hasn't made eye contact with Lindsay since the fifth grade, much less spoken to her, much less insulted her. You heard me. A bitch. A mean girl. A bad person. Juliet turns to Allie next. You're a bitch, too. To Elodie, you're a bitch. She turns her eyes to me, and for a second I see something flashing there, something familiar, but just as quickly it's gone. You're a bitch. We're all so shocked. We don't know how to respond. Elodie giggles again nervously, hiccups, and goes silent. Lindsay's mouth is opening and shutting like a fish's, but nothing's coming out. Allie's balling up her fists like she's thinking of clocking Juliet in the face. And even though I'm infuriated and embarrassed, the only thing I can think when I look at Juliet is, I never knew you were so pretty. Lindsay pulls herself together. She leans forward so her face is only inches from Juliet's. I've never seen her so angry. I think her eyes are going to pop out of her head. Her mouth is twisted into a snarl like a dog's. For a second, she looks really and truly ugly. I'd rather be a bitch than a psycho, she hisses, grabbing Juliet by the shirt.
Spit is coming out of her mouth. That's how angry she is. She shoves Juliet backward, and Juliet stumbles into Matt Dorfman. He pushes Juliet again, and she careens into Emma McElroy. Lindsay starts screaming, "Psycho! Psycho!" and making the high-pitched knifing noises from the movie, and suddenly everyone's screaming out, "Psycho!" and making the motion of an invisible knife and screeching and pushing Juliet back and forth. Allie's the first to overturn a beer on her head, but everyone catches on to that, too. Lindsay splashes her with vodka, and when Juliet stumbles my way, half-drenched, arms outstretched, trying to get her balance, I grab a half-finished beer from the windowsill and dump it on her. I don't even realize I'm screaming along with everybody else until my throat is sore. Juliet looks up at me after I dump the beer out. I can't explain it. It's crazy, but it's almost a pitying look, like she feels bad for me. All of the breath leaves my body in a rush, and I feel like I've been punched in the stomach. Without thinking, I lunge at her and shove as hard as I can, and she goes backward into a bookshelf that almost falls over. I've pushed her back toward the door, and as everyone is still squealing and laughing and screaming, "Psycho!" she runs out of the room. She has to squeeze by Kent. He's just come in, probably to see what everyone's screaming about. We lock eyes for a moment. I can't exactly tell what he's thinking, but whatever it is, it's not good. I look away, feeling hot and uncomfortable. Everyone's buzzing with energy now, laughing and talking about Juliet, but my breathing won't go back to normal, and I feel the vodka burning my stomach, creeping back up my throat. The room is stifling, spinning faster than before. I have to get out for some air. I try to push my way out of the room, but Kent gets in my face and blocks my way. "What the hell was that about?" he demands. "Can you let me by, please? I'm not in the mood to deal with anyone, and I'm especially not in the mood to deal with Kent and his stupid button-down shirt." "What did she ever do to you?" I cross my arms. "I get it. You're friends with Psycho, is that it?" He narrows his eyes. "Pretty clever nickname. Did you think of that all by yourself, or did your friends have to help you?" "Get out of my way." I manage to squeeze past him, but he grabs my arm. "Why?" he says. We're standing so close together, I can smell that he's just eaten peppermints and see the heart-shaped mole under his left eye, even though everything else is blurry. He's looking at me like he's desperate to understand something, and it's worse, much worse, than anything else so far. Than Juliet, or his anger, or the feeling I'm going to be sick any second. I try to shake his hand off my arm. "You can't just grab people, you know? You can't just grab me! I have a boyfriend!" "Keep your voice down. I'm just trying to... Look!" I succeed in shaking him off. I know I'm talking too loud and too fast. I know I sound hysterical, but I can't help it. "I don't know what your problem is, okay? I'm not going to go out with you. I would never go out with you in a million years, so you can stop obsessing over me. I mean, I shouldn't even know your name." The words fly out, and it's as though they strangle me on the way up. Suddenly, I can't breathe. Kent stares at me hard. Then he leans in even closer. For a second, I think he's going to try to kiss me, and my heart stops. But he just puts his mouth up to my ear and says, "I see right through you." "You don't know me." I jerk backward, shaking. "You don't know one thing about me." He holds his hands up in surrender and backs off. "You're right. I don't." He starts to turn away and mutters something else. "What did you say?" My heart is pounding in my chest so hard I think it will explode. He turns to look at me. "I said, thank God." I spin around, wishing I hadn't borrowed a pair of Allie's heels. The room spins with me, and I have to steady myself against the banister. "Your boyfriend's downstairs, puking in the kitchen sink," Kent calls after me. I give him the finger over my shoulder without turning around to see if he's watching me, but I get the feeling he's not. Even before I go downstairs to see whether what Kent said about Rob is true, I know it. Tonight isn't the night after all. The combination of disappointment and relief is so overwhelming, I have to hold on to the walls as I walk, feeling the stairs spiral up under me like they're going to slip away any second. Tonight isn't the night. Tomorrow, I'll wake up and be exactly the same, and the world will look the same, and everything will feel and taste and smell the same. My throat gets tight, and my eyes start to burn, and all I can think in that moment is that it's all Kent's fault. Kent's and Juliet Sykes. Half an hour later, the party starts to wind down. Inside, someone has ripped the Christmas lights off the wall, and they're trailing along the floor like a snake, lighting up the dust mites in the corners. I'm feeling better now, more like myself.
There's always tomorrow,
Lindsay said to me when I told her about Rob, and I run the phrase over and over in my head like a mantra. There's always tomorrow. There's always tomorrow. I spend 20 minutes in the bathroom, first washing my face and then reapplying makeup, even though my hands are unsteady and my face keeps doubling in the mirror. Every time I put on makeup, it reminds me of my mother. I used to watch her bend over her vanity getting ready for dates with my father, and it calms me down. There's always tomorrow. It's the time of the night I like best, when most people are asleep and it feels like the world belongs completely to my friends and me, as though nothing exists apart from our little circle. Everywhere else is dark and quiet. I leave with Elodie, Allie, and Lindsay. The crowd is thinning as people take off, but it's still hard to move. Lindsay keeps calling out, excuse me, move it, feminine emergency. Years ago, we discovered at an under-18 concert in Poughkeepsie that nothing clears people faster than referencing a feminine emergency. It's like people think they'll catch it. On our way out, we pass people hooking up in corners and pressed against the stairwell. Behind closed doors, we hear the muffled sounds of people giggling. Elodie slams her fist against each door and yells out, no glove, no love. Lindsay turns around and whispers something to Elodie, and Elodie shuts up and looks at me guiltily. I want to tell them I don't care. I don't care about Rob or missing my chance, but I'm suddenly too tired to talk. We see Bridget McGuire sitting on the edge of a bathtub with the door just cracked open. She has her head in her hands and she's crying. What's wrong with her? I say, trying to fight the feeling of swimming in my own head, of my words coming from a distance.
She dumped Alex.
Lindsay grabs onto my elbow. She seems sober, but her pupils are enormous and the whites of her eyes bloodshot.
You'll never believe it. She found out that the Nick Nazi busted Alex and Anna together. He was supposed to be at a doctor's appointment.
The music's still going, so we can't hear Bridget, but her shoulders are shaking up and down like she's convulsing.
She'll be better off. Scumbag.
They're all scumbags, Elodie says, raising her beer and spilling some of it. I don't even think she knows what we're talking about. Lindsay takes her cup and sets it on a side table on top of a worn copy of Moby Dick. She pockets a little ceramic figurine, too, a shepherd with curly blonde hair and painted eyelashes. She always steals something from parties. She calls them her souvenirs.
She better not hurl in the tank, she says in a whisper, tipping her head back toward Elodie.
Rob is stretched out on a sofa downstairs, but he manages to grab my hand as I go by and tries to pull me down on top of him.
Where are you going?
He says. His eyes are unfocused and his voice is hoarse. Come on, Rob, let me go. I push him off me. This is his fault, too.
We were supposed to...
His voice trails off and he shakes his head confused, then narrows his eyes at me.
Are you cheating on me?
Don't be stupid. I want to rewind the whole evening, rewind the past few weeks, go back to the moment when Rob leaned over, rested his chin on my shoulder, and told me he wanted to sleep next to me. Go back to that quiet moment in that dark room with the TV blue and muted in front of us and the sound of his breathing and my parents sleeping upstairs. Go back to the moment I opened my mouth and heard, I do too.
You are. You're cheating. I knew it.
He lurches to his feet and looks around wildly. Chris Harmon, one of Rob's best friends, is standing in the corner laughing about something, and Rob stumbles over to him.
Are you cheating with my girlfriend, Harmon?
Rob roars and pushes Chris. Chris stumbles and knocks against a bookshelf. A porcelain figurine topples over and shatters, and a girl screams.
Are you crazy?
Chris jumps back on Rob, and suddenly they're locked together, wrestling, shuffling around the room, and knocking into things, grunting and yelling. Somehow Rob gets Chris down on his knees, and then they're both on the floor. Girls are shrieking and jumping out of the way. Someone cries out, "Watch the beer!" just before Rob and Chris roll up against the entrance of the kitchen where the keg is sitting.
Let's go, Sam.
Lindsay squeezes my shoulders from behind. I can't just leave him, I say, though a part of me wants to.
He'll be fine. Look, he's laughing.
She's right. He and Chris are already done fighting and are sprawled on the floor laughing their heads off. Rob's gonna be so pissed, I say. And I know Lindsay knows I'm talking about more than just ditching him at the party. She gives me a quick hug.
Remember what I said, she starts to sing song. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow.
For a moment, my stomach clenches, thinking she's making fun of me, but it's a coincidence. Lindsay didn't know me when I was little, wouldn't even have spoken to me. She has no way of knowing I used to lock myself in my room with the Annie soundtrack and belt that song at the top of my lungs until my parents threatened to throw me out onto the street. The melody starts repeating in my head, and I know I'll be singing it for days. Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you tomorrow. A beautiful word, when you really think about it.
Lame party, huh?
Allie says, coming up on the other side of me. Even though I know she's only pissed Matt Wilde didn't show, I'm glad she says it. The sound of the rain is louder than I thought it would be, and it startles me. For a moment, we stand under the porch eaves, watching our breath condense into clouds, hugging ourselves. It's freezing. Water is falling in steady streams from the eaves. Christopher Tomlin and Adam Wu are throwing empty beer bottles into the woods. Every so often, we hear one shatter, and the sound comes back to us like a gunshot. People are laughing and screaming and running in the rain, which is coming down so hard, everything looks as though it's melting into everything else. There are no neighbors to call the cops for miles. The grass is churned up, great black pits of mud exposed. Headlights are flashing in the distance, in and out, on and off, as cars sweep down the driveway toward Route 9.
Run for it,
Lindsay yells, and I feel Allie tugging on me, and then we're running, screaming, the rain blinding us and streaming down our jackets, the mud oozing into our shoes, rain so hard it's like everything is melting away. By the time we get to Lindsay's car, I really don't care about the awful way the night turned out. We're laughing hysterically, soaked and shivering, woken up from the cold and the rain. Lindsay's squealing about wet butt marks on her leather seats and mud on the floor, and Elodie's begging her to go to Mix for an egg and cheese and complaining that I always get shotgun, and Allie's yelling for Lindsay to turn on the heat and threatening to drop dead right there from pneumonia. I guess that's how we get started talking about it. Dying, I mean. I figure Lindsay's okay to drive, but I notice she's going faster than usual down that awful, long, penned-in driveway. The trees look like stripped skeletons on either side of us, moaning in the wind. I have this theory, I'm saying, as Lindsay skids out onto Route 9 and the tires shriek against the slick, black road. The clock on the dashboard is glowing, 12:38. I have this theory that before you die, you see your greatest hits, you know? The best things you've ever done?
Duke, baby,
Lindsay says and takes one hand off the wheel to pump her fist in the air.
First time I hooked up with Matt Wilde,
Allie says immediately. Elodie groans and leans forward, reaching for the iPod.
Music, please, before I kill myself.
Can I get a cigarette?
Lindsay asks, and Elodie lights one for her off the butt she's holding. Lindsay cracks the windows, and the freezing rain comes in. Allie starts to complain about the cold again. Elodie puts on Splinter by Fallacy to piss Allie off, maybe because she's sick of her whining. Allie calls her a bitch and unbuckles her seatbelt, leaning forward and trying to grab the iPod. Lindsay complains that someone is elbowing her in the neck. The cigarette drops from her mouth and lands between her thighs. She starts cursing and trying to brush the embers off the seat cushion. And Elodie and Allie are still fighting, and I'm trying to talk over them, reminding them all of the time we made snow angels in May. The clock ticks forward, 12:39. The tires skid a little on the wet road, and the car is full of cigarette smoke, little wisps rising like phantoms in the air. Then all of a sudden, there's a flash of white in front of the car. Lindsay yells something, words I can't make out, something like sit or shit or sight. And suddenly the car is flipping off the road and into the black mouth of the woods. I hear a horrible screeching sound, metal on metal, glass shattering, a car folding in two, and smell fire. I have time to wonder whether Lindsay had put out her cigarette. And then, that's when it happens. The moment of death is full of heat and sound and pain bigger than anything. A funnel of burning heat splitting me in two, something searing and scorching and tearing, and if screaming were a feeling, it would be this. Then nothing. I know some of you are thinking maybe I deserved it. Maybe I shouldn't have sent that rose to Juliet or dumped my drink on her at the party. Maybe I shouldn't have copied off Lauren Lornett's quiz. Maybe I shouldn't have said those things to Kent. There are probably some of you who think I deserved it because I was going to let Rob go all the way, because I wasn't going to save myself. But before you start pointing fingers, let me ask you, is what I did really so bad? So bad I deserved to die? So bad I deserved to die like that? Is what I did really so much worse than what anybody else does? Is it really so much worse than what you do? Think about it. Chapter 2. In my dream, I know I'm falling, though there is no up or down, no walls or sides or ceilings, just the sensation of cold and darkness everywhere. I'm so scared I could scream, but when I open my mouth, nothing happens. And I wonder, if you fall forever and ever and never touch down, is it really still falling? I think I will fall forever. A noise punctuates the silence, a thin bleeding growing louder and louder until it's like a scythe of metal slicing the air, slicing into me. Then I wake up. My alarm has been blaring for 20 minutes. It's 6:50 a.m. I sit up in bed, pushing away the comforter. I'm covered with sweat even though my room is cold. My throat is dry and I'm desperate for water like I've just been running a long way. For a second, when I look around the room, everything seems fuzzy and slightly distorted, like I'm not really looking at my room, but only at a transparency of my room that's been laid down incorrectly so the corners don't match up with the real thing. Then the light shifts and everything looks normal again. All at once, it comes back to me and blood starts pounding in my head. The party, Juliet Sykes, the argument with Kent. Thammy! My door swings open. Banging once against the wall, and Izzy comes galloping across the room, stepping all over my notebooks and discarded jeans and my Victoria's Secret team pink sweatshirt. Something seems wrong. Something skirts the edges of my memory, but then it is gone, and Izzy is bouncing on my bed, throwing her arms around me. They are hot. She curls a fist around the necklace I always wear, a thin gold chain with a tiny bird charm hanging from it, a gift from my grandmother, and tugs gently. Mommy said you have to get up. Her breath smells like peanut butter, and it's not until I push her off me that I realize how badly I'm shaking. It's Saturday, I say. I have no idea how I got home last night. I have no idea what happened to Lindsay or Elodie or Allie, and just thinking about it makes me sick. Izzy starts giggling like a maniac and bounces off the bed, scurrying back toward the door. She disappears down the hallway, and I hear her call out, Mommy! Thammy won't get up! She says my name, Thammy. Don't make me come up there, Sammy! My mom's voice echoes from the kitchen. I put my feet on the ground. The feel of the cold wood reassures me. When I was younger, I would lie on the floor all summer when my dad refused to turn the air conditioning on. It was the only place that stayed cool. I'm tempted to do the same thing now. I feel feverish. Rob. The rain, the sound of bottles shattering in the woods. My phone chimes, making me jump. I reach over and flip it open. There's a new text from Lindsay.
I'm outside. Where are you?
I snap my phone shut quickly, but not before I see the date blinking up at me. Friday, February 12th. Yesterday. Another chime. Another text.
Don't make me late on Cupid Day, biatch.
I suddenly feel like I'm moving underwater, like I'm weightless or watching myself from a distance. I try to stand up, but when I do, my stomach bottoms out and I have to rush to the bathroom in the hall, legs shaking, certain I'm going to throw up. I lock the door and turn on the water in both the sink and the shower. Then I stand over the toilet. My stomach clenches on itself, but nothing comes up. The car, the skidding, the screams. Yesterday. I hear voices in the hallway, but the water's rushing so hard I can't make them out. It's not until someone starts pounding on the door that I straighten up and yell, "What? Get out of the shower! There's no time!" It's Lindsay. My mom's let her in. I crack the door a little, and there she is, her big, puffy jacket zipped to her chin, looking pissed. I'm happy to see her, anyway. She looks so normal, so familiar. "What happened last night?" I say. She frowns for a second.
"Yeah, sorry about that. I couldn't call back. I didn't get off the phone with Patrick until, like, 3 a.m.
"Call back?" I shake my head. "No, I meant..."
"He was freaking out over the fact that his parents are going to Acapulco without him."
She rolls her eyes.
"Poor baby."
"I swear to you, Sam, guys are like pets. Feed him, pet him, and put him to bed." She leans forward.
"Speaking of which, are you excited about tonight?"
"What?" I don't even know what she's talking about. Her words are all running past me, blurring together. I'm holding onto the towel rack, afraid I'll fall over. The shower is on way too hot, and there's thick steam everywhere, clouding up the mirror, condensing on the tiles.
"You rob some Miller Lite in his flannel sheets?" She laughs. "Very romantic."
I have to shower. I try to close the door, but she wedges her elbow in at the last second and pushes into the bathroom.
"You haven't showered yet?"
She shakes her head.
"Uh-uh. No way. You'll have to do without."
She reaches into the shower and turns off the water, then grabs me by the hand and drags me into the hallway.
"You definitely need some makeup, though," she says, scanning my face. "You look like shit. Nightmares?"
"Something like that."
"I have my MAC stuff in the tank."
She unzips her coat, and I see a white tuft of fur peeking out from her cleavage. Our Cupid Day tank tops. I suddenly have the urge to sit down on the floor and laugh and laugh, and I have to struggle not to have a fit right there while Lindsay's shoving me into my room.
"Get dressed," she says, and pulls out her cell phone, probably to text Elodie we're going to be late.
She watches me for a second and then sighs, turning away.
"Hope Rob doesn't mind a little B.O., she says,
and as she giggles over this, I start pulling on my clothes, the tank top, the skirt, the boots. Again. Does this straitjacket make my butt look big? When Elodie gets into the car, she leans forward to grab her coffee, and the smell of her perfume, raspberry body spray she still buys religiously from the body shop in the mall, even though it stopped being cool in seventh grade, is so real and sharp and familiar, I have to close my eyes, overwhelmed. Bad idea. With my eyes shut, I see the beautiful warm lights of Kent's house receding in the rearview mirror and the sleek black trees crowding on either side of us like skeletons. I smell burning. I hear Lindsay yelling and feel my stomach bottom out as the car lurches to one side, tires squealing.
Shit.
I snap my eyes open as Lindsay swerves to avoid a squirrel. She chucks her cigarette out the window and the smell of smoke is strangely double. I'm not sure whether I'm smelling it or remembering it or both.
"You really are the worst driver," Elodie giggles.
"Be careful, please," I mutter. I'm clutching the sides of my seat without meaning to.
"Don't worry," Lindsay leans over and pats my knee.
I won't let my best friend die a virgin.
I'm desperate to spill everything to Lindsay and Elodie at that moment, to ask them what's happening to me, to us, but I can't think of any way to say it. We were in a car accident after a party that hasn't happened yet. I thought I died yesterday. I thought I died. Tonight. Elodie must think I'm quiet because I'm worried about Rob. She loops her arms around the back of my seat and leans forward.
Don't worry, Sam. You'll be fine. It's just like riding a bike,
Elodie says. I try to force a smile, but I can barely focus. It seems like a long time ago that I went to bed imagining being side by side with Rob, imagining the feel of his cool, dry hands. Thinking about him makes me ache, and my throat threatens to close up. I suddenly can't wait to see him, can't wait to see his crooked smile and his Yankees hat and even his dirty fleece that always smells a little bit like boy sweat, even after his mom makes him wash it.
It's like riding a horse,
Lindsay corrects Elodie.
You'll be a blue ribbon champion in no time, Sammy. I always forget you used to ride horses.
Elodie flips open the lid of her coffee and blows steam off the top. When I was like 7, I say, before Lindsay can turn this into a joke. I think if she starts making fun of me now, I really will cry. I could never explain the truth to her, that riding was my favorite thing in the world. I loved to be alone in the woods, especially in the late fall when everything is crisp and golden, the leaves the color of fire, and it smells like things turning into earth. I loved the silence. The only sound, the steady drum of the hooves and the horses breathing. No phones, no laughter, no voices, no houses, no cars. I flipped the visor down to keep the glare out of my eyes, and in the mirror I see Elodie smiling at me. Maybe I'll tell her what's happening to me, I think. But at the same time, I know that I won't. She would think I was crazy. They all would. I keep quiet and look out the window. The light is weak and watery-looking, like the sun has just spilled itself over the horizon and is too lazy to clean itself up. The shadows are as sharp and pointed as needles. I watch 3 black crows take off simultaneously from a telephone wire and wish I could take off too. Move up, 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 and watch the ground drop away from me the way it does when you're on an airplane, folding and compressing into itself like an origami figure, until everything is flat and brightly colored, until the whole world is like a drawing of itself.
Theme song, please,
Lindsay says, and I scroll through her iPod until I find the Mary J. Blige, then lean back and try not to think of anything except the music and the beat. And I keep my eyes open. By the time we pull into the drive that winds past the upper parking area and down to the faculty lot and senior alley, I'm actually feeling better. Even though Lindsay's cursing and Elodie's complaining that one more tardy will get her Friday detention and it's already 2 minutes after first bell. Everything looks so normal. I know that because it's Friday, Emma McElroy will be coming from Evan Danzig's house, and sure enough, there she is, ducking through a clipped portion of the fence. I know Peter Court will be wearing a pair of Nike Air Force Ones he's had for 1,000,000 years because he wears them every day, even though there are so many holes in them you can see what color socks he's wearing, usually black. I watch them go flashing by as he books it down toward the main building. Seeing all these things makes me feel 1,000 times better, and I start thinking maybe all of yesterday, everything that happened, was just some kind of long, strange dream. Lindsay cruises down to the senior alley, even though there's 0 chance of finding a spot. It's a religion for her. My stomach dips when we pass the 3rd spot from the tennis courts, and there's Sarah Grundle's brown Chevrolet with its Thomas Jefferson swim team sticker, and another one, smaller, that reads, "Get Wet," staring at me from the bumper. I think, she got the last spot because we're so late. And I have to squeeze my nails into my palms and repeat to myself that I've only been dreaming, that none of this has happened before.
I can't believe we have to walk 0.22 miles,
Elodie says, pouting.
I don't even have a jacket.
You're the one who left the house half naked,
Lindsay says.
It is February.
I didn't know I'd be outside. We pass the soccer field on our right as we loop back toward Upper Lot. At this time of year, the fields are all churned up, just mud and a few patches of brown grass.
I feel like I'm having deja vu,
Elodie says.
Flashback to freshman year, you know?
I've been having deja vu all morning, I blurt out before I can stop myself. Instantly, I feel better, sure that that's what this is.
Let me guess.
Lindsay brings one hand to her temples and frowns, pretending to concentrate.
You're having flashbacks to the last time Elodie was this annoying before 9 a.m.
Shut up! Elodie leans forward and smacks Lindsay's arm, and they start laughing. I smile, too, relieved to have spoken the words out loud. It makes sense. One time, on a trip to Colorado, my parents and I hiked up 3 miles to this little waterfall smack in the middle of the woods. The trees were big and old, all of them pine. The clouds were streaked across the sky like spun sugar. Izzy was too young to walk or talk. She was riding in my dad's baby backpack, and she kept punching her tiny fat fist at the sky like she wanted to grab it. Anyway, as we were standing there, watching the spray of water on the rocks, I had the craziest feeling that it had all happened before. Down to the smell of the orange my mom was peeling and the exact reflections of the trees in the surface of the water. I was positive. It became the big joke that day, because I'd complained about having to hike 3 miles, and when I told my parents I was having deja vu, they kept laughing and saying, it really would be a miracle if I'd ever agreed to walk that far in a past life. I guess my point is only that I was sure then. Just like I'm feeling sure now. It happens.
Oh!
Elodie squeals and starts digging through her purse. She knocks out a pack of cigarettes and 2 empty tubes of lip gloss, plus a misshapen eyelash curler.
I almost forgot your present.
She sends the condom sailing over the front seat, and Lindsay claps her hands and bounces in her seat when I hold it up.
No glove, no love? I say, managing a smile.
Elodie leans forward and kisses my cheek, leaving a ring of pink gloss.
You're going to be great, kid.
Don't call me that, I say, and drop the condom in my bag. We step out of the car, and the air is so cold my eyes sting and start to water. I ignore the bad feeling buzzing through me, and I think, this is my day, this is my day, this is my day. So I can't think of anything else. A shadow world. I read once that you get deja vu when the 2 halves of your brain process things at different speeds, the right half a few seconds before the left, or vice versa. Science is probably my worst subject, so I didn't understand the whole article, but that would explain the weird double feeling that it leaves you with, like the world is splitting in half, or you are. That's the way I feel, at least. Like, there's a real me and a reflection of me, and I have no way of telling which is which. The thing about deja vu is that it has always passed really quickly. 30 seconds. A minute, at most.
But this doesn't pass. Everything is the same.
Eileen Cho squealing over her roses in first period, and Samara Phillips leaning over and crooning, he must really love you. I pass the same people in the halls at the same time. Aaron Stern spills his coffee all over the hallway again, and Carol Lynn starts screaming at him again. Even her words are the same. Were you dropped on your head 1 too many times or something? I have to admit it's pretty funny, even the second time around. Even when I feel like I'm crazy, even when I feel like I could scream. But even weirder are the little blips and wrinkles, the things that have shifted around. Sarah Grundle, for example. On my way to second period, I see her standing against a bank of lockers, twirling her goggles around her index finger and talking to Hillary Hale. As I walk by, I catch just a bit of their conversation.
So excited. I mean, coach says my time could still go down by a half second.
We have 2 weeks before the semis. You can totally do it, I stop dead when I hear this. Sarah sees me staring at her and gets really uncomfortable. She smooths her hair and tugs on her skirt, which is riding up on her waist. Then she waves.
"Hey, Sam,"
she says. She pulls on her skirt again. "Were you..." I take a deep breath to keep from stuttering like an idiot. "Were you just talking about semifinals? For swim team?"
"Yeah."
Sarah's face lights up.
"Are you gonna come?"
Even though I'm freaking out, it still occurs to me that this is a really stupid question. I've never gone to a swim meet in my life, and the idea of sitting on a slimy tile floor and watching Sarah Grundle splash around in a bathing suit is about as appealing as the chow mein from Hunan Kitchen. To be honest, the only sporting event I ever go to is homecoming, and after 4 years, I still don't understand any of the rules. Lindsay usually brings a flask of something for the four of us to share, so that could have something to do with it. "I thought you weren't competing." I try hard to act casual. "I heard some rumor, like maybe you were late and the coach freaked out."
"You heard a rumor about me?"
Sarah's eyes go wide and she looks like I just handed her a winning lotto ticket. I guess she's of the no press is bad press philosophy. I guess I was wrong. I think of seeing her car in the third to last spot and feel heat flood my face. Of course she wasn't late today. Of course she's still competing. She didn't have to walk from upper lot today. She was late yesterday. My head starts pounding and suddenly I just want to get out of there. Hillary's looking at me strangely.
"Are you okay? You look really pale."
"Yeah, fine. Bad sushi last night." I put one hand on the lockers to steady myself. Sarah starts babbling about the time she got food poisoning from the mall, but I'm already walking away, feeling like the hallway is rolling and buckling underneath me. Deja vu. It's the only explanation. If you repeat something enough, you can almost make yourself believe it. I'm feeling so shaken up, I almost forget that Allie's waiting for me in the bathroom by the science wing. I go into the stall and flip the lid of a toilet down and just sit there, only half listening while she babbles. I remember something Mrs. Harbour once said on one of her crazy tangents in English, that Plato believed that the whole world, everything we can see, was just like shadows on a cave wall. We can't actually see the real thing, the thing that's casting the shadow in the first place. I have that feeling now, of being surrounded by shadows, like I'm seeing the impression of the thing before the thing itself.
"Hello? Are you even listening to me?"
Allie rattles the door and I look up, startled. I notice AC equals WT scrawled on the inside of the door. Below it, a smaller note reads, "Go back to the trailer, ho." "You said pretty soon you'd have to shop for bras in the maternity section," I say automatically. Of course I wasn't really listening. Not this time, anyway. I'm wondering vaguely why Lindsay came all the way down here to write on the bathroom wall. Why it was important to her, I mean. She'd already written it a dozen times in the stalls across from the cafeteria, and that's the bathroom everyone uses. I'm not even sure why she dislikes Anna. And it reminds me that I still don't know when she started hating Juliet Sykes so much either. It's weird how much you can know about someone without knowing everything. You'd think someday you'd come to the end of it. I stand up and swing the door open, pointing to the graffiti. "When did Lindsay do this?" Allie rolls her eyes.
"She didn't. Copycat artist."
"Really?"
"Uh-huh. There's one in the girls' locker room, too.
Copycat." She whips her hair into a ponytail and starts pinching her lips to make them swell up.
"It's so lame. We can't do anything in this school without everyone doing the same thing."
Lame. I run my fingers over the words. They're thick and black, like worms drawn in permanent marker. I wonder briefly whether Anna uses this bathroom.
"We should sue for copyright infringement." "Can you imagine? $20 for every time somebody bites our style. We'd be rolling in it."
She giggles.
"Mint?"
Allie holds out an Altoids tin. Even though she's still a virgin and will be for the foreseeable future, or at least until she goes to college, since she's completely obsessed with Matt Wilde, she insists on taking birth control pills, which she keeps crumpled up in their foil pack right there alongside her mints. She claims it so her dad won't find them. But everyone knows she likes to flash them during class so that people will think she's having sex. Not that anybody's fooled. Thomas Jefferson is small. You know these things. One time, Elodie told Allie she had pregnancy breath, and we all died over it. It was junior year in May, and we were all lying out on Allie's trampoline. It was the Saturday morning after she'd had one of her best parties yet. We were all just a little hungover, our brains fuzzy, stuffed on all the pancakes and bacon we'd put down at the diner, totally happy. I lay there while the trampoline dipped and swayed, closing my eyes against the sun, wishing that the day would never end. The bell rings and Allie squeals, "Oh, we're gonna be late!" Again, that pit opens in my stomach. A part of me is tempted to hide all day in the bathroom, but I can't. I know you know what happens next. That I get to chem late? That I take the last seat next to Lauren Lornet? That Mr. Tierney passes out a quiz with 3 questions on it? The worst part of it? I've seen the quiz before, and I still don't know the answers. I ask to borrow a pen. Lauren starts whispering to me. She wants to know if it's working okay. Mr. Tierney's book comes down with a bang. Everyone jumps but me. Class, bell, class, bell. Crazy. I'm going crazy. By the time the roses get delivered in math class, my hands are shaking. I take a deep breath before I open the little laminated card attached to the rose Rob sent me. I imagine it will say something incredible, something surprising, something that will make everything better. You're beautiful, Sam. I'm so happy to be with you. Sam, I love you. I lift the corner of the card gently and peek inside. Love you. I close the card quickly and put it in my bag. Wow, it's beautiful. I look up. The girl dressed like an angel is standing there, staring at the rose she just laid on my desk. Pink and cream petals swirled together like ice cream. She still has her hand outstretched and tiny blue veins crisscross her skin like a web. Take a picture. It'll last longer. I snap at her. She blushes as red as the roses she's holding and stammers out an apology. I don't bother reading the note that's attached to this one, and for the rest of the class, I keep my eyes glued to the blackboard to avoid any sign from Kent. I'm concentrating so hard on not looking at him, I almost miss it when Mr. Daimler winks at me and smiles. Almost. After class, Kent catches up with me, holding the pink and cream rose, which I'd deliberately left on my desk. You forgot this, he says. As always, his hair is flopping over one eye. It's okay, you can say it. I'm amazing. I didn't forget it. I'm struggling not to look at him. I didn't want it. I sneak a glance at him and see his smile fade for a second. Then it's back on, full force, like a friggin' laser beam. What do you mean? He tries to pass it to me. Didn't anybody ever tell you that the more roses you get on Cupid Day, the more popular you are? I don't think I need any help in that department, especially from you. His smile definitely drops then. Part of me hates what I'm doing, but all I can think of is the memory or dream or whatever it is when he leans in and I think he's going to kiss me, I'm sure of it, but instead he whispers, I see right through you. You don't know me. You don't know anything about me. Thank God. I dig my nails into my palms.